I'm calling the School Finance Reform Task Force to order. Thanks everyone for being here today. I'm Senator Terry Bonoff. Today I'll be chairing this task force, and I chaired this task force alongside Representative Mindy Greiling and Commissioner Alice Segrin, and so we've been trading off. We had our first meeting last month. Today's meeting, we have the opportunity to have two speakers here with us, and before I talk about who those speakers are, I just wanted to give you a sense of why we're talking about what we're talking about today. You know, as people know, this task force came about because in the legislative session, we said that we would meet during an interim to talk about some of the challenges that our school funding formula has, with the expectation and the hope that we would finish this work with recommendations that could be dealt with during the legislative session. And as we look at the school funding formula, each in our various districts have different challenges. So the suburban districts have challenges, the city districts have challenges, and the regional small school districts have challenges. We decided that in today's session, we would let each of us talk about all of the challenges we face, but in particular, we would focus on the declining enrollment and small school challenges. So we are fortunate to have two experts talking about that with us today. And the first person that we're going to hear from is Mike Griffith. And I am going to let Representative Greiling talk about the organization Mike's with, because she actually serves in the same organization as does the commissioner. So with that, I'll turn it over to Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Chair Bonoff. I would also welcome Mike Griffith, and Commissioner Segrin and I do both serve on the Education Commission of the state, and it is the commissioner, the governor, two House members, one of each party, and two representatives, one of each party, and then higher ed, and am I missing anybody, Commissioner?
No, I think you're
right. Okay. And the idea is that all the 50 states will meet together and pool resources so that every state has a team and places to go to find out what the other states are doing. And we have things like National Council of State, a Conference of State Legislators, and CSG, but this one is focused only on education. And we're lucky that Greg Vandell, who's the chair of PS Minnesota, has his cousin, Bruce, who actually went from working with Carlos Mariani at the Minnesota Minority Education Partnership to the Education Commission of the States in Denver. So we feel like we have a real pipeline to them, and they have offered to be a resource to us with some of the issues we're dealing with, including the one that Senator Bonoff just listed. So I too want to welcome Mike Griffith. We are very pleased to have you here and hope to keep up the dialogue with our whole task force discussion. And before we turn it over to Mr. Griffith, I'd like the people at the table to introduce themselves. We have people from both the Senate and the House, and we have issued the invitation to all of our members to join us. And so those who are at the table that aren't officially on the task force, I'd like you to introduce yourself, and your comments are welcome as well.
I'm Representative Carol McFarland. Oh, my goodness.
Senator Sandy Rummel, Senate District 53, White Bear Lake, Shoreview, Centennial. Like I said, I should do District Centennial, White Bear Lake, and Moundsview.
Senator Dan Scogin, District 10, Fergus Falls, Durham, Pelican Rapids, Verndale, Wadena, Deer Creek, Monaga, Topeka, New York Mills. Got about 15 of them.
Patricia Torres-Ray, represent District 62 in the Minnesota Senate, and I represent the Minneapolis School District.
And I am Senator Amy Koch from Senate District 19, which is most of Wright County. This will be an interesting presentation. Declining enrollment is not an issue where I'm from, so this will be educational.
Representative Jim Dabney represents part of South Minneapolis and taught for 17 years in Buffalo.
Very good. And I, by the way, I represent the Minnetonka, Wayzata, Hopkins, Robbinsdale, and a small piece of the Oxdale School District.
Mm-hmm.
You wanna? And I'm just I'm 10 minutes north of the capital, Roseville, Lauderdale, St. Anthony Village. Mr. Fifth, welcome.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Is this yes.
This is a further introduction of ECS. I think you already talked about it in pretty good detail, but some other details about us if you just wanted to know who we were. We are a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization serving 50 states, two territories in the District of Columbia. And anything I talk about today, you can pretty much find on our website at ecs.org. And I've got contact information at the end if you'd like to email me or give me a call to ask questions or to get this full PowerPoint presentation. This is what I've got set up to talk about today. My hope is that we have some time afterwards to talk about some other issues outside of small schools, outside of declining student enrollment. But this is what the PowerPoint presentation itself is about. Touching on the idea that there are a lot of issues around small schools, small school districts, that there is a difference in small school districts between those who are small by choice and then small by necessity, that there are some solutions that other states have found, and then finally we'll talk a little bit about declining student populations and how some states have handled that issue, which goes really hand in hand with the idea of small schools. There are a lot of studies and a lot of work that have been done on this issue, and they don't come to a complete agreement on many things, but on the one thing they do come to an agreement on is that small schools produce a higher per student cost than what you would term regular size schools. In fact, you can think of it as a U-curve in the sense that schools that are sort of the mid-size have the lowest cost per student. As you move up the ladder, or move down the ladder, I should say, to school district size, the cost per student greatly increases. As you move up the ladder, the cost per student increases. As you move beyond essentially 10,000 students in a district, and in some studies have shown as little as 5,000, you start having additional costs for each student that you educate. As you start moving below about 1,500 students, the studies have shown, you start to have an added cost per student. Now, not every study agrees. Some go as high as 2,500. Some would say you need to get below 500 before you have an increased student cost. But in general, they pretty much agree on the 1,500 number. Then beyond small districts, you have the extremely small districts. This is debatable how big these are. These are, in some cases, again, 500 or less. In other cases, they defined it as small as 50 students. But these places have incredibly high costs in comparison per student to traditional districts. In a lot of states, these are the type of school districts that they attempt to address in their funding formula. Very few districts look at just small. They want to look at extremely small when dealing with providing additional funding. This is where you get into the issue. Is a district small because it chooses to be small? Is those people running it choose it to be small? Or is it small because it's isolated? And we would use the term isolated. You can use the term sparse. You could use several other different terms. But essentially, is it small and impossible for that district to combine with another district at some point? These are the ways states have chosen to define those districts that have no choice but to be small. That they are a certain distance away from one school to the next. That they look at the student density numbers, in other words, the number of students by the number of miles of the school district. They look at something like the amount of time that a student would need to spend on a bus to get from one school to the next. And then other geographic considerations. The easiest one to think of is the geographic one. These are school districts that are islands. In Colorado, we have school districts that are in mountain valleys that cannot be combined with other districts. And in other cases, you might be on a peninsula or something like that. Those are easy for everyone to understand that they're isolated and they can't be combined with another district. Travel time is another pretty easy consideration there. You don't want to put a kid on a bus for 2 or 3 hours. There is a district in Kansas that has about 150 kids and it's the size of a county. Right now they have to put their kids on a bus for 2.5 hours on average to get them to their school. They have no choice though. They're so small that they have to do something like that. But they could never combine with another district. That would mean the kids would spend even more time on a bus. And then the idea of school density and distance from schools, again, feeds basically into the idea of travel time for students. That's always one of the main concerns when looking at this. When ECS looked into this issue about 2 years ago, we were asked by the state of Montana to look at other states and see how they treated and funded sparsely populated school districts and what their definitions were of what is sparse, what is isolated, and then how they went about trying to provide additional funds, and then what that funding level really consisted of. We looked at the 11 states that are listed there. Your state was actually one of the states that we reviewed. These states were actually chosen by Montana. There are three other states that have sparsity indexes that were not included in this, and they are Kansas, Nebraska, and Indiana. But then you can see of these, only four of them provided money just to a school because it was small, not because it's geographically isolated. North Dakota is a great example. As you move down the ladder in your student population, you gain an additional weight per student that you have. It basically does it in about blocks of 100 or so students. And the complaint there, and you know, there has been a lot of studies to pull this out, but the complaint in North Dakota is that you're actually encouraging small school districts. So you have two districts located next to each other. If they combined, they would actually receive less money on a per student basis. So they receive more money by being a smaller, separate district than combining to a larger district. The same is true with the South Dakota formula. The Alaska and Idaho ones are a little different, so they don't get the complaint as much about being a sort of system that encourages smaller districts, unnecessarily small districts.
Excuse me, Mr. Griffiths. We have a question. Commissioner Fagan. Mr. Griffiths, you just said South Dakota has a similar formula as North Dakota, which encourages small schools?
Yes.
I thought South Dakota, after the size of 100, if they fell below 100 students, then their, forget what their index is called, does not apply.
But once you get down to the 100, as you drop down, and I have to look at it again, you might be right under the 100, but it does provide you additional funding as your district shrinks in size.
Only up to 100 students, I think, then after that, they don't get any more money.
Okay. Well, and then that may be correct. At least when I looked at it, this would have been information from 3-4 years ago. Do you know when the changes were made in South Dakota?
I don't, but Mr. Meltzer's sitting in the audience.
And they don't have the issue in South Dakota of the number of districts that they do in North Dakota.
Yeah.
I mean, that's been an ongoing issue in North Dakota, and they've attempted to look at the consolidation. It has not come up as much in the state of South Dakota.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. No, thanks. Good input. These are the four states that provide additional funding to districts that are small. This is how they define the extremely small districts. Alaska's 250 or under. There was South Dakota. I had 200 as the number, but you're saying you think it's 100. That could be correct. And then in North Dakota, it's a high school district that's 75 students, elementary school district of 100, or an elementary school district that is a one-room elementary district, no matter, regardless of the size. Nine of the six we looked at provided additional funding to isolated districts, and the list is there. Five of these states used a combination of factors to define what an isolated school was. So they looked at things such as distance of time traveled by a student, the sparsity population index, or I'm sorry, that's your measure, the number of students per square mile, in the distance between schools. If you met those qualifications, then you automatically qualify for isolated school funding in those states. In West Virginia and Wyoming, you simply had to be below a certain number of students per district. Then you applied to the state and requested to be defined as an isolated district. So there was a combination there of the minimum or the maximum number of students you could have, but then the decision had to be made in the state. In Idaho and Washington, you had to have both things. You had to go through and meet a bunch of different criteria, and then you also had to have the state define you. You have to apply and have the state define you as isolated before you can receive the additional funding. 8 of the 9 states have provided funding for isolated districts and caps on the size of the districts or schools. 4 of the states and had maximum size of districts, and it ranged from 100 in Vermont to 1,400 in West Virginia. Vermont right now is going back and looking at it, looking at their funding formula. Again, I should also say Arkansas is mentioned in this. Arkansas has eliminated their incentives for smaller districts when they changed the funding system over about a year and a half ago, because the governor felt like the system had encouraged smaller districts. So they're another one, even though they're on this list, their funding program really no longer exists. In the Vermont system, they're going back and looking at it, changes again, and again in attempts for consolidation in that state. 4 other states have school size caps, which range from 35 to 599 there in North Dakota and Wyoming. Once they've identified the districts or the schools that they consider to be isolated, then they have different ways of them providing funds to those places. In Idaho, West Virginia, and Wyoming, it's essentially a decision of policymakers that they define those districts that are isolated, and within their budget request to the legislature, they request additional funds for those districts that are isolated. It's less of a predictable system. You may get an awful lot of money in a certain year. You may not get any in the next year, depending on what was recommended by the policymakers and then what was approved eventually by the legislators. This is how the other states, some of the systems that they use to provide money to the isolated districts. In North Dakota, they increased student weight by 20%. So in other words, each student received 20% additional funding. So if a student was a general ed student, they would receive 20% over a general ed. If they were an at-risk student, they receive additional weight beyond that, an additional weight because they are in a isolated district. Oregon has a sliding scale, anywhere from 0.3% to 100% additional funding for students located in these districts. Vermont provides a supplement of up to $2,500 per student. That again ranges depending on your size and your wealth. And then Washington has a funding system, and only about 6 or 7 other states have. Idaho has it also, where they provide teaching positions per school, and then they fund partially or fully those teaching positions depending on your school district's wealth. And so what happens is when you have a smaller school in Washington, they provide you funding for an additional teacher position depending on the formula. The one thing you can find when you look at all of these states is that no two states define what is isolated is the same. Once they define what is isolated, they don't fund it the same way. There is no holy grail. Even those who have a pretty clear-looking funding system in place, they came up with this funding system based on guesswork and then based on available funds. It's not coincidental that the breakoffs are always sort of even numbers, 50, 100, 200. Things tend not to flow that perfectly. They chose those because they made sense at the time. The amount of money provided, if you go through and talk to the people who worked on these in different states at different times, they will be pretty honest with you and say, it was the money that we had at the time that we felt we could afford to give to these smaller districts. If you ask them if that additional money directly matches the additional cost to these smaller districts, they'll say that they don't really know, that this is the best guess estimate at doing this. Another issue that really pops up for small schools is the idea of declining student populations. When every district is affected by declining student populations, but these smaller school districts tend to be impacted at an even greater sort of rate. There are a couple of things you can do for declining student populations. ECS has taken a look at this, and there are really, you know, 4 basic sort of answers. The first is you allow districts to average out their student counts over a period of years. This allows there, instead of to be a dramatic drop from one year to the next, if you lose a group of students, that you can phase that drop in over time. The other is that you allow them to take the best single year. One of the problems that small school districts have, if you're a 100-kid school district, you could lose 10 kids in a year. That means you'd lose 10% of your state funding. But then the next year, you might gain back 8 of those kids. If you allow them to average it out, they won't see the ups and downs on a system like that. The same if you allow them to choose the best count within a 3 to 5 year period. Then some states have decided that they put in their formula a maximum decrease in student population. And the idea is here that you will never lose more than 1%, no matter what your real count is, of your student count for the funding formula purposes. And then the other is just a flat-out hold harmless. In some states, Rhode Island and Pennsylvania, for example, no district will receive less in any school year than it did in the previous school year. So that's great.
Excuse me, Mr. Griffith.
Sure.
With regard to the maximum decrease in students, the states that are doing that, is that based on there's a certain cost that it takes to operate that school?
Yeah.
And has that been calculated succinctly, or...?
No. The truth is, all of these try to take into account the idea that even if you're losing students, you've got some fixed costs there that you can't adjust. And even if you're that 100-kid school district that loses 10 kids, they're not all coming from the same class. You can't suddenly eliminate a teaching position. And you can't suddenly shut down 10% of your school or that. So you're trying, in each of these, you're trying to take that into account that, yes, there's a recognition that you've probably got some reduced costs, but it's not equal to the number of students that you've lost. The states that put that number in there, from, again, people I've talked to in trying to figure out where they came up with certain numbers, it was really based on the idea that it's what they felt was fair. And it's usually one, the states that I know that have it, they're only a handful, but it's usually, say, 1% to 5% in that range mm-hmm. that will never let you decrease more than that in any given year. So, and the problem with people, oh, I'm sorry.
Yes, that's it. Commissioner? I know in Minnesota we have a transportation sparsity formula. Do any of the other states recognize that transportation as a cost for sparsely located districts or districts that...
It may exist, but I haven't seen it. The belief tends to be that that amount is rolled in with your sparsity cost because that's one of the larger costs that you have as a small school district. You have a disproportionately high, usually, mm-hmm. transportation cost. What you do here is you try to recognize both. You have your sparsity index, which tries to deal with the operating side, but then you have your sparsity transportation that deals with that bigger issue. What some of them do is simply within your funding, within the transportation funding formula, you would have, that would be taken into account in some way, because you would get a funding amount from the state based on the amount of average miles that your students have to go. So if you're a sparsely populated district, you would receive additional funding for that.
Mm-hmm.
In some states, they simply said, Maine used to have a system like this where we will cover a certain percentage of your transportation costs regardless of what they are. So in that case, you'd be benefiting sparsely populated districts. Maine eventually eliminated that because that kind of system can encourage inefficiencies because it simply was you just tell us what you spent and we'll give you, mm-hmm. I think it was 60% back, something like that. So they do try to take it into account, but you guys just do it in a slightly different way in the sense that you just remove it and have it as a separate sort of standalone system. Just quickly on the issue with hold harmless provision is when you have a hold harmless provision in place, it can cause a lot of problems within your funding formula simply because you're getting away then from funding different districts on a per student basis. And so you can have one district that has 100 kids, the district next to it only has 70, but they're funded at the same rate because at one time the 70 district actually had 100 kids. So you're keeping them at the same level. The states that have that tend to be pretty unhappy with the complete hold harmless, and they're looking towards something more of an averaging, where they don't want to take all the money away in any one given year, but you sort of decrease the hit that any school district would take in any single year. So, and then I'd like to, any questions or comments that you have or anything I didn't touch on? Or?
Representative Heidgerken, and do you want to introduce yourself?
Thank you. State Representative Bud Heidgerken, and I come from Lake Wobegon, okay? And but anyways, I represent 13 school districts, central Minnesota.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Griffith, I'm just wondering at that point you were talking about small schools or small school districts. There's always a slash up on the screen and a slash implied in your voice. Are there any states that provide specific funding to support small schools, even those within larger districts, whether the small school is based on declining enrollment, a sparse student population, even in a larger population center, or a small school that's a specific educational strategy?
There are a couple states that have pilot programs, because there's more and more research showing that small schools have pretty good outcomes. The question again is, what is a small school? You know, that definition really gets kind of booted around a lot, but the idea is there is a pretty good amount of research now. You have groups like the Gates Foundation that are out there. They themselves are funding small school programs in a number of states, but they tend to be in large urban areas where they're looking at creating essentially brand new schools that are small schools that they fund. I don't know of any state that is going out wholesale and doing this, where they're creating a funding system, a program within their funding system that creates or encourages smaller schools directly. Like I said, there's a couple pilot programs out there. There is private money that's coming into the system. There are schools that have taken their own money, school districts, and set it aside and attempted to do this. Seattle is out there doing this. I believe Portland, Detroit, in a way to try to, you know, it's not just an experiment, a way to try to move things forward and see if they can get this to work. So, you know, I wish I could tell you of something more solid than that.
Thank you.
Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Griffith, when I see those numbers of students in a school, is that K-12, 112, E-12?
It varies by state, but most of the time what they're talking about are district numbers that would be a K-12 district. In some cases, in certain states, they have K-6, K-8 districts that they're using those numbers for. When you talk about school size as opposed to district size, then states tend to break it up and differentiate between the size of a high school and then the size of an elementary school. And so, you know, it varies from time to time. If you've got a question about any of the specific ones, I could run it through later.
And then on the four, you know, reducing the impact, the four different choices, the averaging, and mm-hmm. did there seem to be one of the four, or did something seem to rise to the surface as you talk to these schools in these states that seemed to make the most sense?
The averaging tends to be the most popular and, in a way, makes the most sense.
For stability,
sort of all around, because what you did is you're helping the school districts out in a sense, but you're not substantially changing your funding formula to do it as you would with the whole harmless. You're also taking into account, because the small districts do fluctuate an awful lot, when you're dealing with that few students, you can have two families move in, and it can dramatically change your enrollment count. So they wanted to keep that too. So you can't think of them as declining in a sense. They're just moving, the population numbers moving. So that tends to be the most popular. So allowing districts to choose their favorite, and in a way this is in an exact order of how their popularity. I did that accidentally, but it worked out. It allows them then to, it very much looks like the averaging in a way. There's a whole lot of difference between those two. And then the third one is the maximum decrease in students. That would be the third most popular. The least popular is the hold harmless. It does not mean, though, that every state has one of these. I'd say, you know, probably 35 to 40 of the states have this, but there are 10 or 15 that have nothing. And so as your student population drops, then you receive a drop in school funding at the same time.
Mr. Griffith, I know that in Minnesota we do have something built into our formula for small schools. Besides just the sparsity and the transportation, we have the formula with regard to declining enrollment. Have you looked at our formula, and do you have any comments about that?
Yeah, and honestly, I thought it made a lot of sense, the sparsity index that you have. It tries to take both into account the distance from school district and the population density, distance from school and population density. I believe it's based on 400 students for a high school and 20 students per grade for an elementary school. That makes a lot of sense. You know, and so it seems to be a pretty good logical standing point. You know, the question is, do you think the funding level is sufficient? I think you'd have to go out and essentially do a separate study in the state to see what are the real costs for the districts, the smaller districts in the state, and see if that matches up. You can do that through a survey, or you can do that through examining their books, essentially. But.
And Commissioner, would you like to say something about what else?
We also have a declining enrollment portion of our formula, don't we, still, with the 70, what's the percentage now, 77.23, which, you know, allows for using, multiplying 77% of what last year's number, or the reverse of that, okay, I'm looking at my But that also softens the blow when you're declining, especially if you all of a sudden lose quite a few.
And that's the idea between all of these. There are different ways to cut it, but you're getting at the same problem that you don't want to overly punish a district for losing kids, but you still eventually have to take that into account. If they continue to decline, you can't fund them at the same level that they were at. So, you know, one isn't incredibly better than the other. It's more of a policy decision on how you feel. If you feel comfortable with that sort of phase, and which is a two-year count where two-thirds of it, or three-quarters of it, then you're taking into the current year, one you're looking back, it's another way of averaging. So a three-year average would be probably a little more generous than your current system, but it would be somewhere around the same.
Commissioner, and one of the dilemmas, and we've had this, you know, discussion so many times in our committees, is separating out the very isolated school district that has no opportunity to really either do any kind of pairing or any kind of, even if you're not talking about the C word, consolidation, but if you are isolated, and so then how do you, if the students have no other opportunity except where they're living, you know, like your example at the end of a peninsula or in the mountains or somewhere, where you have to, you know, give those students an education, and then how do you fund and keep that small school operating that's isolated versus we have, you know, a number of schools in the state that are within a geographic distance that they're maybe 4 or 5 miles from one another, the buildings are, and yet, you know, there's this really great resistance of you know, trying to consolidate. Are, you know, sometimes there are the agreements to, you know, share some facilities or you know, maybe one of the districts does the K-6 and the other does the, you know, the other part, but we went through a time when we did do a lot of consolidation, and I think we're at another point where we need to think about it, but yet, you know, after a certain amount of time, that's not going to be possible anymore. And then you do get into the isolation thing. And then I think we need to think outside of the box a little bit, too, as far as it's, and that's what I wanted to ask you, even though you might fund a teacher in some of these states where you're guaranteed a teacher, you know, so many teachers, after a while, though, you still can't provide the depth of offerings that a larger district can. And so I think you really do have to start thinking about online learning opportunities, ways of still having those students be there in that district, having teachers there, but also providing additional educational opportunities. It's for me, and the bottom line is, what can we do to get education to the kids? And we may not be able to afford, you know, a biology teacher, a physics teacher, a chemistry teacher, when there's only two kids in the whole, you know, school. So at that point, then you've really got to start thinking more creatively.
And we've seen a decent amount of states start moving that way. And they have an online learning program that then provides AP or courses or advanced courses that you couldn't get if you're in these smaller districts. There's all sorts of ways to fund that. In Kentucky, the state funds it. Has the program, runs it, but then you as a school district pay a tuition amount per student for them to attend. Or if you're a parent that's homeschooling, or even if they're in the public school and you just want them to take these courses, you can pay an amount too and have them take that course. What they found in Kentucky and in many of the other states where they were doing online learning is that if you set up the system just a computer system for kids to tap into, their success rates are not that high. What you have to do is have a teacher who's on the other line that they can talk to. And the teacher-student ratio can be much different than in the classroom, but they still have to be probably in the 50 or so range per teacher for them to be able to provide the time. When you have those two things combined, then you start seeing kids have a greater success rate. The truth is those programs cost more than other online programs because you have somebody there, but there's still less of a cost than having a teacher themselves there. And one of the questions when you do costing out a small school, that's always the issue, what would it cost for a very small school to get a qualified physics teacher in to teach a single course to maybe five students? There is no costing model that can tell you that. In some cases, the person just isn't in that area. You couldn't bring them in physically if you wanted to. In other cases, you might find them, but they don't want to come in to teach 1 hour a day. You know, they would charge you essentially the full amount for having to come in for 1 hour. What we've seen some small schools do now, if they're fairly close to each other, is start sharing those types of services. And I don't want to step on the toes of the next presenter. I think he's going to be talking about something like that. But that is something that we've seen that's out there, where you joint, three of you, four of you, jointly hire a physics teacher or a chemistry teacher, and then that person moves from school to school to do these things. We've seen things like mobile labs pop up, where science labs are shared by a whole group of schools, and it's on a tractor trailer bed, and it moves from school to school, and again, saves money. So there are things out there that you can do, that sharing of services and so forth, or especially what online learning is, which is contracting on services.
Thank you. Representative Dowling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Griffith, I wanted to ask, I think I asked you about this ahead of time, and I'll ask to get a public answer, but some of our school districts, not the isolated ones, but the ones, the second type that Commissioner Segan was talking about, that are near other schools or have more less enrollment in their own district, have tried to consolidate or close a school, and then a charter school pops up because the families are wedded to that school, and never mind about efficiencies. Have any other states addressed that?
Not really. I mean, the issue of charter schools, have they talked about it and debated it in other states? Absolutely. Ad nauseum. But have they done anything? No. It becomes a difficulty because what do you do then? When you originally had, and if this is the kind of scenario I'm thinking of, where you had sort of a 400-student school, you tried to combine it with another local school, but now instead you have two 200-kid school and a 200-kid charter school. That kind of thing, there really is no solution to unless you essentially forbid charters in those places. And I haven't heard anyone who would like to do that. So I don't know the way around it. You can mandate that charters need to have a certain number of kids before they can open up. You might even talk about that they can only open up in districts that have a certain number of students per square mile. But, you know, those things are, I think, pretty difficult to do. Where we've seen charters cause more of a problem with student enrollment are the larger urban districts. And you look at a place like Detroit, which has been losing about 25,000 students a year for the last 5 years, mostly due to charters, some transferring to other school districts. That's an incredible hemorrhage. And that's a big issue in that city. Again, I don't know what the solution is. That goes sort of beyond, that's why I'm glad I just deal with funding, because that's more than a funding question. But it does cause a problem, and it is something that people are trying to get at.
Mr. Griffith and members of the committee, we all know this is an issue because we have been supportive of charter schools, and yet some of the problems are that charter schools don't have the same populations as our public schools. They may not have the same special ed populations, so the costs aren't the same, and this has become an issue in terms of who's choosing to go to these charter schools and then the burden that places on a school with declining enrollment. So those are the kinds of questions that I think we will have to address as we address this broader issue. And I know that later during this hearing, we will be talking about some of the other factors, and given your expertise, if you're in the room, we may call you back up to ask you how we deal with some of those factors and other things. Thank you.
Good.
Very good.
Now I'd like Mr. Warren, Lee Warren, to come and address the committee. Mr. Warren is with MREA. So if you both just introduce yourselves to the committee. Thank you.
Madam Chair, my name is Lee Warren. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Rural Education Association, and I've invited Cliff Carmody, who is the Executive Director of the Service Cooperative in Marshall, along, because I'm going to be using him as an example during my presentation. I thought he ought to be here to defend himself if I talk about him. So I want to make sure that I get this thing working.
Yeah, I'm late.
I'm going to push over here. I'm going to check first before I panic. Madam Chair, members of the committee, while we're getting the technology working, we're sharing equipment. I want to give you a little background before I get into some of the details to help you get a picture of what I'll be talking about. One of the 44 states in the country use regional delivery. They're called educational service agencies. This is their generic term. And I've been very actively involved with them across the country, and recently have spent a bunch of time going around and talking to a number of these groups. Commissioner Segrin was had a chance to visit with a bunch of those people, and in the process of looking at declining enrollment and how we go about addressing some of those issues and the current economic situation we find ourselves in, with the probability of a lot of money being thrown at a problem just because it's going to be there. Regional delivery seemed like a logical place to start to talk about how do you deal with declining enrollment. Across the country, there are many different kinds of agencies. Here in Minnesota, we have about four or five different agencies. The intermediate districts in the metro area, I think you're aware of them. Service cooperatives, which is created in statutes, and the handout that you have, the last couple of pages are the statutes creating the service cooperatives. Education districts were created in the mid-80s, funded, and then special education cooperatives, and there are other joint powers or other groups that have been utilized over the years. But there are a number of these educational service agencies around the country. Where Mike is from, they're called the Boards of Cooperative Educational Services in Colorado. In other states, in Texas, they're called Educational Service Centers, and they all have different names, but they have very similar services that they provide. I provided a list of just some of the services that these four basic agencies that I listed here in Minnesota provide, and you're probably aware of them, everything from special education to vocational services, but they go way beyond that. Different models exist around the state. They're just plain, around the country, they're just not the same. In Minnesota, the agency that CLEP runs was actually started in 1965 as a cooperation between higher ed and a couple of school districts. They then became a funded pilot program called an Educational Research and Development Commission, and then that went on. In 1976, the legislature created these regional agencies, which were essentially around the governor's planning region. Those models then had relationships to each other and to the state. There was some funding that went to them to help them do regional planning, and in fact, the statute requires them to do regional planning and delivery of services. In some states, they have very tight relationships with their departments of ed, and other states they don't. In the state of Minnesota in 1992, I think there was sunset legislation put together to eliminate this. There was a myriad of these intermediate agencies stacked on top of one another. The thought was, there's all this governance, we're spending all this money on stuff, let's just get away. We're wasting too much money, let's get away with it. In 1995, when the legislation was supposed to take effect, then they said, we're just not going to fund you. If you're any good, you'll survive. Otherwise, you'll die and wither on the vine. And what essentially happened was that it created an entrepreneurial system. And Minnesota was one of the first in the country to go through entrepreneurism in regional delivery. And that's a two-edged sword, a good thing and a bad thing, depending upon your point of view. Certainly you've heard about some of the entrepreneurism that's taken place either through cooperative purchasing hearings that Commissioner Segrin had when she chaired the House Finance, but also you've heard about health insurance and other things. But what they really do is spend a lot of time delivering other kinds of services as well. And I list for you the statute. It says the primary purpose, they're supposed to do regional planning and delivery, working with people. And it lists the next few slides with a dozen different things that they're expected to do, including just about anything that anybody asks them for. And then I wanted to focus on the slide that talked about technical assistance, providing technical assistance for long-range planning available.
Which, unfortunately, we seem to have a problem with your technical assistance.
I can grab my computer. It's the same presentation that you have here.
Yeah, I think that's fine, Mr. Warren. Yeah, we can all follow. If people would just follow along with their packet, let's not worry about it.
And most of all these services are provided in one way or another by many of the different agencies that I've listed on the page. And each state is a little different. So what I thought I'd do is point out what's happening today. And then I'm going to pick on Cliff. I'm going to use his agency as an example, and that's why I brought him up here so he can answer your question. Currently, the department is using this regional delivery model by doing school improvement, the AYP process, and they essentially established a standardized process to help schools that get into AYP get out of AYP, do a better job. And they use these regional delivery centers, the Metro Exodus in this area, and I think six other service centers around the state. And so everybody's doing the same thing, helping those, and they work together collaboratively, work directly with the department. There's a direct relationship. And I think the science and math teachers academies that are being discussed, I think the plan there is to use a similar delivery model. And in a number of states, that's exactly what they do with the regional centers. Texas, Commissioner Neely has talked a lot about how they use theirs, and in other states do the same thing. So what I wanted to do is then take the Southwest Coast Central out of Marshall and point at them. Other agencies do very similar things as well. I'm just going to pick on Cliff and tell you what it is that they're doing now, and then end up talking about what potential may exist for you to look at and discuss about doing regional deliveries in a way that would save money without having you necessarily put a lot more money into the system, which doesn't exist anyway. In the Southwest, the 18-county region, Cliff is providing superintendent services, principal services, curriculum directors. He's got business managers going out from school to school. He does it remotely. He does it on site. They're paying their bills in some cases where they don't have somebody in-house doing it. They do an incredible depth of technology coordination, online delivery. They have four special ed cooperatives that operate out of their shop, and over 100 specialist teachers on staff, and that would be psychologists and speech language pathologists and people like that that move around. They drive more than 1,000,000 miles a year moving these specialists around and delivering their services to various places. It spent a lot of time dealing with technology simply because it's possible to do a lot more, as was earlier talked about. As a matter of fact, and although it's not in here, he just finished putting up a wide area network, the only wireless wide area network that's of its kind in the state, covering the region, and their bandwidth went from 1.5 megabits per second up to possible 100 megabits per second for less money than they were paying before. And they're pioneering all kinds of things like that that can more easily be done on a large scale than not. They're doing a lot of curriculum assistance, which works hand in glove with the project that the department has that's going through them. And they do an awful lot of business management services. Heck, they train the auditors that go into school districts to do their auditing. They have the financial expertise, and they would have like the equivalent of a TIE inside their system or an ESB region. They do the finance, payroll, student reporting, all those things. And a lot more. And other agencies that I haven't highlighted do a lot of unique things too, and there's a lot of other possibilities. So I would suggest to you that it might be worth having a discussion about utilizing the statutes that we have in place, utilizing the infrastructure that already exists in terms of these different intermediate agencies to take a look at, are there ways for us to do some things more efficiently than we do today? A good example, and I hear this as I travel around the state a lot, why is it that three buses are driving down my road and they're all three from different school districts? Can't you guys get this thing figured out so that we're not having that problem? Or somebody will say something about, well, why is it, and by the way, I did a study for seven districts together, this was just a couple, 3 years ago, had a total of 1,200 students. By the way, they only have 900 today. 1,200 students, and they had 5 superintendents. Those things don't make a lot of sense to me. Today they've got 900 students, 4 superintendents, so they're getting better. But the point is, there is a certain aggregation benefit that can happen depending upon what the service might be. Cliff is doing natural gas aggregation. I don't think anybody's doing that. It's deregulated. It's hard to do. Not everybody gets natural gas, and it's tough because some municipals supply gas, and you get all those other kinds of political problems revolving around that. Food service, all those other kinds of things. So I threw some ideas out. Early childhood would be a perfect example to talk about. How do you bring the early childhood, all of the variety of providers and others together to provide some coordination so that we can maybe do some of the things that are being talked about this weekend, Monday, during the Growth and Justice presentation? Certainly a number of those things could be addressed. And so, Madam Chair, I just bring this up as a real quick kind of, here's what it is, and I'm sure we'd be glad to answer any questions.
Well, Mr. Warren, thank you very much, and those are just the kinds of things that we on this task force are interested in. How can we think creatively to be more efficient, to use our resources to more effectively so that we can actually use our dollars to improve student learning? So thank you.
Questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize, Carl, I didn't catch your last name.
It's Cliff Carmody.
Or Cliff?
Yep.
What seems to be the most cost saving, then, of the services you provide? What do the districts tell you that you're doing the best at?
Thank you. I think the program that I would say is the foundation of what we do in our agency is special education. We have almost 250 employees now. Half of them are special education teachers, and the way the model works
is that districts need access to certain services, and by aggregating those services and sharing a staff person, we're able to bring those services to a district that couldn't afford them if they had to go out to hire on their own. One of the special challenges in special education is we're finding it more and more difficult to hire the folks that provide those services. The example I would use would be speech and language pathologists. At one point in time this last year, we had 7 openings just in our agency alone, and we had a number of school districts in our region that were looking for speech and language pathologists as well. One of the innovative things we're trying to do there is use our technology to do what we call teletherapy, to use technology to do some speech and language services over technology and do it that way. And so I think the core part of what we do, and I think the core savings, really becomes in our ability to use special education services. There's a caveat with special education that it's a little bit different. There's federal dollars that are available when we do special education. We believe that our agency could do some of those same kinds of things and provide greater access to some of our rural schools in the areas of regular education around curriculum development, assessment, staff development kinds of things. Another example I might share with you is we have 3 years now we've done a preschool, if you will, in service, and it's grown from about 900 teachers in the region to well over 1,600 teachers in the region are coming to a central location for a day of in-service activities that they can't do on their own. So that's really the kinds of things that we're trying to do. It's more difficult than regular ed, obviously, because of some of the funding constraints around the resources and how you allocate them. But when we get districts to look at that and share those resources, we're able to provide those.
Based on previous testimony, are you dealing mostly with small districts?
The average size school district, we have in our region, we're 18 counties, we have 40 some school districts. The average size school district, I would say, would be under 800 students. The largest school district in our region would be Wilmer.
Senator Scobie, you have a follow-up?
Well, I was just curious, when you're sharing things like special ed, are they within reasonable, well, obviously reasonable, but fairly close to each other to them? Or?
For the most part, we have, again, because of some of the recent difficulties we have in hiring people, some we'll have some positions that will serve upwards 6 or 7 different schools. That gets to be a lot of travel time. That's been a consistent challenge for us, I think, historically, is how do we eliminate as much windshield time, if you will, when we provide those services. But all in all, it comes down to access to those services and how we do that the most efficient way possible. And I think, for the most part, there are some geographic concerns, but we're able to handle those by using groups of schools. When Mr. Warren talked about our special ed co-ops, we have 4 centers, and so we take those 40-plus school districts and we put them into smaller groups. For example, in our Pipestone Center, we have 15 school districts that reduce that geographic size of 18 counties down to a more manageable level.
And then are you offering any of your services online?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, we've talked a lot about, you know, we've done ITV, interactive television programming, for 20-plus years. We talk about the online access. I would support what was stated earlier. The challenge with online is there still needs to be some component of working with that child on site. And we've done some of those kinds of things as well. We think that technology, and we have about a half a dozen technology folks today that go out into our districts and help serve the hardware side. We just this year added a technology integration specialist because we believe that using technology to enhance what's going on in the classroom is the next thing that we need to start helping our districts with, whether it's straight online or it's a combination of online and ITV or whatever that might be. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Culp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to ask sort of the flip side of that coin. Are there services that are, you mentioned the natural gas, are there other services that districts are looking for you to provide or that you would just see as not potential services that could be provided or something that's not so easy for the co-ops to?
There's probably nothing that we couldn't provide. I think the challenge becomes very often the challenge that you address quite often, and that is due to the independent nature of many of our school districts, some of those things they want to do by themselves. and they like that local control piece. I think there's some political realities there as well, but I think the models that we use in providing the services, I can't see anything that, for the most part, at least in our region with our membership, that we couldn't help them with.
Yes. Representative McFarland.
Madam Chair, I'm just wondering, do the cooperatives ever get together to talk about what they're doing amongst each other so you're not working all independently?
Yes. In fact, we meet on a monthly basis. Seven of us meet monthly. We talk about sharing those services. I think historically we've gotten better at doing that. I think part of the project that we're working with the department on the Adequate Yearly Progress, the AYP, and the school improvement has helped to facilitate more of that going on. It's a common agenda with a common need for us to get together. So yes, we do get together and talk about those services that we provide.
Representative Farrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Either one of you, I'm wondering if we need any legislative changes to the, you mentioned using the current statute and then just having more of this go on. Obviously, we have the poster child with us, but then the other entrepreneurs haven't developed quite as extensively. Do we need any incentives from the legislature, or is the current statute sufficient?
Madam Chair, Representative Grelling, one of the things I think that the department has done really well in putting this school improvement AYP process together was there was some funding available to help get the bodies to do it, because it's hard to get the districts to, you know, give up the money that they're currently spending in other things in order to do the school improvement. But along with that came the here's what we're going to get done, and by the way, we're going to be partners in this. And I think that process has really worked well in terms of making sure that the department is getting its desired outcome and the districts are getting their service, and there were some financial drivers to make that happen. I think the legislation is permissive in terms of allowing things to happen, but maybe some assistance to help either do a pilot or do some things that maybe there's some specific things that you'd like to have done. I know that early childhood has been talked about a bunch, and that certainly is an opportunity. There may be many others that you could do, that you could take a look at that would help, that no necessary boundaries. In other words, they're able to be replicated at any level. I think we have to think about all kids in all circumstances, and certainly whatever it is that we do, it ought to be available in, you know, to be scalable wherever we use it.
Mr. Warren, you had mentioned the possibility of doing something with regard to transportation, given some of those challenges. What are your thoughts about how that might look like, or what that might look like?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's interesting because when you think about transportation, and I'm kind of a recovering superintendent, there are private contractors, there are individual districts that own buses, and there are parents moving kids around in various fashions, whether that be for handicap reasons or other things. I think dealing with the transportation issue, at least on, you know, from a more rural base, and maybe other places as well, it's eliminating the duplication that comes through having isolated delivery. If Cliff and I are independent districts and we're delivering our stuff, I don't need to talk to him about my buses. And by the way, I'm going to take some of your kids because open enrollment allows me to do that, so I'm just going to run a bus over and pick them up. Not a big deal. By the way, I'm not going to necessarily give you the kids that are going your direction and vice versa. So we see this duplication. And I think, Madam Chair, what would probably help is some coordination, either authorization for coordination or incentive for coordination, something, so that we don't have that. We can eliminate that duplication. You know, if we're all running buses here, and I'm taking kids that are going right by Representative Heidgerken's place, I might as well pick them up for them and just drop them off. We'll make the exchange where it makes good sense. The folks that have been doing bus transportation for a number of years, and I use like St. Paul and Suburban or Ryder and other people, have very sophisticated software that indicates where kids live, where they got to go. You punch it in, and it helps You know, I mean, with today's GPS stuff, it's unbelievable what it can do. Why wouldn't we take that and use it on a larger basis, irregardless of the artificial boundaries of independent districts, and figure out how to make that happen? I don't know if I'm smart enough to say exactly how that would work, but it seems like that would be a logical process.
Thank you. It makes sense to me as well, especially in some of the more densely populated areas where you have districts that bump up against each other and there's so many kids, and for each district to have to carry those costs does seem excessive. Representative Heidjerkin.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Warren, I agree with you on the bus situation, you know, and I've alluded to that a number of times, I think, Alice. When you were also chair, we talked about those issues. And I agree with you. The governor had an idea a number of years ago that somehow got lost. He had proposed, and I think Commissioner Seeger can remember that, consolidation of administrative services as part of his initiative. And I like the idea, and we had some long discussions on it. The only thing I didn't like about his idea, he wanted the districts to be contiguous. And when you do that, the regional centers are going to win out, and small schools are just going to disappear. So that will not work. I mean, it's tough enough time maintaining your school districts that are very, very isolated. But I think that had we done that, you would have saw the Atwaters, where 67% of the schools passed referendums this last year. I had 8 in my district, all 8 failed. All 8. Not even close. Atwater's been trying for years and years and years. They've gone through, I think, 4 superintendents in the last 2 years. But I think had Atwater been given the situation where they could have shared superintendents with Crippleman. BB is going through the process. I think they've got 3 superintendents in the last 5 years. Atwater's got a part-time one. Minnewaska had a part-time one for I don't know how many years. But I think that if you can get the superintendents together, then you can start looking at sharing perhaps the bus lines, like you mentioned. Get the superintendents together and say, look, we're going to have a drop-off point at Sunberg, so you don't have to be, you know, you can save each other a lot of mileage if you're going to continue with open enrollment. And to get rid of open enrollment, it's not going to happen. There's too many people that are in favor of it, and it's working in some areas. But that is one of the points I want to make with you. The other one is that nowhere have I heard anything that will address the issue of declining enrollment. I was hoping that Mr. Griffith would have mentioned that what some of the other states are doing to address that problem. We used to have, and some of you that have been in the education community for some time, in Commissioner Seeger members, we had PNEM that represented Riley, and that was teacher experience mods. If you're out in rural Minnesota, there has been a declining enrollment for the last 20 years. So because of that, you get more and more experienced teachers. Because of that, the experience level is considerably higher than any growth area, because if you're hiring new teachers, you have a higher salary. And that's a big, big factor. And I think that's something we may have to look at, that Commissioner, hopefully, I'm going to be introducing a bill this year reinstating TME, because it's going to help every school district, even some of those in St. Paul and Minneapolis that have declining enrollment. They're going to have the experience factors. The suburbs of growth don't have that. That's a fair way of doing it.
Representative Heidjerkin, the presentation, you came in a little bit later, mm-hmm. that we had by Mr. Griffith. He did talk about what some of the other states okay. were doing, and we'll make sure that you get that information. But I think maybe this is a good time to transition to the next part of the agenda, if anybody doesn't have any more questions. Thank you so much, and again, if you'd stay put, then we may call you back. At this point, you know, because this is a task force and it isn't a regular formal hearing, we wanted to have a more informal discussion where we could just talk about what are the issues. We haven't been able to come to an agreement on how to do funding reform because of our school districts are so different in terms of the specific things that they face, the problems and challenges. So what I'd like to do now is have you just talk about, from your own experience and what you've observed, what are the criteria that make the funding challenging different? So, for example, in
We've often talked about in the suburban schools the cost of living differential. That would be one. But just to open it up and let people talk about that, and Representative Hiker, can you, you know, I mean, we all saw with the referendums that didn't pass, there's a serious problem out there, and we do want to address that. And so if you want to say anything more about what you were talking about.
Thank you. And again, the reason these referendums passed, and some of you were in the legislature in 01 when we had the Ventura tax reform bill, when the state said that they were going to pay 92-94% of funding to children. And we ran out of money, then the new governor said, well, what are we going to do? We can't cut education. Well, you school districts, you can go back and do referendums. Going back to where we were. But what we did in the process, everybody forgets about, we took off, you get out, and I always use it, now it's, I know I was very, the commissioner was very sick of hearing about Minnewaska. But what we did out in Minnewaska is we took half their property wealth away that they had in 01. We said that, you know, henceforth, only an acre and a half out there on these farms are subject to operational referendums. The rest is not. So they lost all of this value they previously had. Then the suburbs came out and said, well, what are you going to do for the farms? We want our cabins all tax exempt on Minnewaska and on Lake Lebanon, Lake Amelia, and Birch Lake and Green Lake and all those lakes out there. So that money is now going into the general. Representative Rukavina and I tried in the House floor a couple of times to get that money from the general back to the school districts where it belongs. But anyways, those are some of the real problems of trying to pass referendums when you only got 50% of your property wealth that you had in 01 left to try to pass an operating referendum. And the majority of the people out there voting are retired people, they're elderly people, and I have 7 nursing homes in my district. Representative Wardlow has none. So there's a difference of trying to get a referendum passed, depending upon where you live. So those are some issues.
Thank you very much. Commissioner?
Well, I think, first of all, the discussion should be about how are we going to deliver educational programming to students across the state and give every student the access that they need and the breadth and depth of educational experiences that they need. And we, you know, always seem to, you know, forget that, and we go off and we look at all of the different, you know, components to see how we can keep a district alive and running and viable versus how do we look at how do we give educational access and how do we put the components in there so that kids can do that. And so you've got, you know, isolated school districts is one issue. And then you have the small districts that are declining and continuing to decline and may be able to, as we had the illustration about using regional cooperative agreements to provide some administrative services. And then, you know, once you start saying, well, how can we deliver those educational programs? And it, you know, it can be a number of ways. We could have the sharing of staff, which is one way. We could have online opportunities, and it doesn't even necessarily, I was thinking about, and we should have had Cliff talk about, they have a really good online program too, where you could even have the teachers in those small schools facilitating that online learning. It doesn't have to be a different teacher from another state even doing it, but, you know, if you have access to that, you still have a facilitation of services. And then you kind of build your program from that point on. Certainly transportation. Then you look at those other additional costs. And I think our state, you know, when you think about we soften the declining enrollment issue now. Is it enough? You know, maybe we need to have that discussion a little bit further. But we account for transportation costs with sparsity, and we have just the operating sparsity program in place for small schools. And then the administrative costs. Again, the example of having 1,200 students going down to 900, and we've gone from 5 superintendents to 4. Well, that's a start. But again, we have, you know, districts that are so much larger than that with one superintendent. And certainly you could, you know, even think about that. But administrative costs are proportionately higher because of that. And it's not the total answer, but I really, you know, wish we would start with what are the educational needs first, and then how do we build build access and do it in a way that, you know, some of it is a little bit outside of the box thinking too. We just are not addressing that in a more innovative way, because we're just going to always have that. And we've got the little angle inlet school that has, what, I don't know what the population is this year, 7 or 10 kids, and we have, you know, one teacher that services those kids, and they come from all over. They come from long distances. So we are going to have some little schools like that, but they don't have a biology teacher, physics teacher, chemistry. They have one teacher, and then they have a lot of other ways that they're accessing information, and they do a lot of internet work, and you ought to go to their website. It's really cool. But I think that's where we need to start, and then build your program that way.
I appreciate that, Commissioner. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I agree and that we need to start out with what do students need and what programming do we need. And I think that's the beauty of actually the PS Minnesota report, because that's how they started out and how they proceeded and how their report ended up where they had the goal of having all the kids pass the standards by 2014, and what would it cost for a Chevy program, not a Cadillac. And with the money that we look like we're facing for next session, certainly the Chevy program has to have some appeal. But so I think for me, that's a very nice place to start, and I really like the regional efficiencies that we talked about today and the transportation. If we could get the Early Childhood Committee involved with us with early childhood and looking at the best way to offer that service. And I'd be very interested in starting out and wonder how much buy-in there is around this table for the PS Minnesota report, if I could get some feedback from people on that so we have a good sense of, is that a place where we can start and branch off from that, or do people not like the report? We already heard from Representative Heidgerken, but the other people. And then I agree with that the next step after we get some idea of that is then how to fund whatever we agree upon. And when we come to that, I think we have to have then part two of the discussion. And Representative Heidgerken mentioned the changes in the property tax, and it wasn't just Minnewaska and other districts in Lake Wobegon that lost half their property wealth. It was districts like mine as well, where the C&I went down to just the plain old market value. And that, if we want to have state funding, then we have to figure out how to have state funding. And if we don't, then we need to look at that as well. And we can't have it both ways, just to say we want state funding, but we want to cut every kind of tax we can come across, because that isn't working very well. So I guess my big question, Madam Chair, is for the other members, is because I would like to start with the PS Minnesota report and get some costing out of that with from the fiscal staff and start looking at the, I think somebody called it the down and right syndrome, you know, where everybody looks at their own districts, because I haven't actually seen the numbers. But I want to know what other people think. Is that a good starting point?
Commissioner, the one thing, and I haven't read the PS Minnesota report for a couple of months, but one of the things, too, I think that we need to discuss is, you know, what is the definition of a small school? I think PS Minnesota had defined it at 4,000 students, and I don't necessarily consider that a small school. I think that's a pretty healthy, viable mm-hmm. school. When you look at the ECS report and the definition of most of the states that have small schools, their definition is much smaller than that. And you know, so what is the, you know, what is the kind of the critical number, if you will, that, you know, you're considering? So I think that we really have to kind of flesh that out, too, and see what we really, you know, call a small school.
Senator Torres, right?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that those definitions and the need to really understand our points of departure are very important, because when we talk about the need to look at formulas and whether or not, you know, our formulas currently address the need of the different districts, what we tend to do is look at the efficiency and how we use the money that we use today. And that's, I think, where we have different opinions as to whether or not we need more money or we need to use the existing funding more efficiently. And we seem to get stuck in that place because we do not have a clear understanding of the current funding and how the current funding does or doesn't meet the needs that the commission is talking about. So when we talk about what is the cost of delivering education today in different areas, it seems to me that we have different views and we have different ways of costing that out. And we differ in terms of opinion as to whether or not we have what it takes, we have too much, or we don't have enough. So we can move into saying we don't have enough and we need more, or we need to take from here and go there. So I don't know if the department is able and willing to help us with that process of defining first whether or not we have somewhat kind of the minimal funding that we need to deliver the education that we value in the state of Minnesota today, so that we can move to the next step, which will be, yes, we have enough, if not, we don't have enough, and this is where we don't have enough, whether that's transportation, ELL, whatever it is. So I think that at least we talk about that in the district a lot, because people tend to talk about efficiency, and that's one of the problems we didn't pass the levy, because people say, well, you have enough, and you're not doing enough with what you have, therefore we're not going to give you more. That's one argument. And do we really know that? I don't know.
Senator Torres, you bring up a good point, and I think one of the problems that I've had with the PS Minnesota report is that in the PS Minnesota report, really there has been a number identified as what's missing to be able to deliver an adequate education in Minnesota. And so we all know that we don't have the kind of resources in the coming year to put that kind of a number back into education. So then what would it look like if we applied the principles of the PS Minnesota report without a large additional amount of money? And that without that large additional amount of money, I suspect that if we did the run on the PS Minnesota model, just the way that it is, there would be huge winners and losers. And then there's ways to deal with that, and maybe you deal with it by having some kind of a hold harmless agreement. And I know Mr. Griffith has talked to me about that certain states have done that. But Senator Torres, I think the PS Minnesota people who did this study would tell you that they've costed it out in their view what it would be. I don't know if the department agrees with that view, and I don't know if our fiscal staff on the House and the Senate side agree with that view. Other comments?
Well, Madam Chair, I think one of the things that, you know, we've talked about is, you know, our staff are, they will, you know, crunch numbers for whatever you want to give, but it's actually looking at the research behind some of the different components of our funding system. I think PS Minnesota really identified the funding components that we do have already. We have the general fund, and then you want to recognize the differences, that the challenges that you have. So you have the compensatory money for at-risk students. You have money for English language learners. You have special education, which of course is the federal mandate. We can go into the complaint about, you know, not having enough money there. But we do have, and then we've recognized small schools, sparsely populated or isolated schools in our formula. So we've got the components, and it's really, I think, deciding, you know, are there adjustments that need to be made to those components? For example, compensatory, the complaint has been that, the urban districts get the majority of that money, and we have poor kids too, so should we get some money? Well, maybe there's some discussion that we need to build some additional support or fairness into that compensatory, not taking money away from the districts that have high concentrations, because I firmly believe that if you have that kind of concentration of need, then, you know, you need to have the support there. Same thing with the ELL. What would be the, we've had the discussion between, we've got right now a limit of 5 years for ELL funding. We've said 7 years. I recently was at a conference where I think it's either Nevada or Arizona have done something very radical where they have created, they've passed a law that says for the first year of any ELL student's, you know, life in school, they have to spend 4 hours a day for that first year in intensive English language learning. And of course, the state that passed that, I think, has up to 45% now of their population that is immigrant population. And then California, for example, is 55% minority now. So their minority is their majority. So it really behooves them to make sure that their students really are getting their English, you know, down very quickly. But that's a different strategy totally. And then, you know, then do you do that real intensive English learning and then have some additional years of support as you go. So those are, I think those are the kind of questions we should be asking, and how do you look at our existing funding system? Because I think that even though people complain about the complexity of it, we have recognized the different needs of districts in some ways. Are these formulas maybe not working as well as they should be doing because they were created several years ago? But then, you know, trying to discern that and maybe trying to create a fair process for all that are slowly getting more immigrant children, slowly getting more poverty, and declining, all of those things that are happening to all of our districts. And again, we've got declining enrollment here in Minnesota, so that's going to be for all of our students except for your area. You're the only area in the state that's probably growing.
I have Senator Saltzman, Representative Dabney, and then Representative McPartland.
Yes, and I apologize for being late, Madam Chair. We had an early literacy hearing today up in Rush City, so we've been visiting some small schools. But I worked for the last 4 years on this initiative as a staff person with C, and before it was ever PS Minnesota, and so I have a lot invested in its past, and I'm very encouraged by this task force being here today. If there was one thing that I remember when the report from John Myers came out, I believe in December of 2005, it was that this isn't just about more money. It's about fixing a system and trying to fix the formula before significant money is put into it. And a lot of what I feel came from that was that what is an adequate education and what is this basic formula all about anymore? And I think what happened a week ago Tuesday with all of our levy referendums and some school districts, you know, losing significant money for the first time, that we absolutely have to focus on what is adequacy, and that we have over the last 30 years tweaked the formula, and there are definitely some need-based, you know, formulas there. But a lot of what's there, it's every year we can look back, for those of you who have been here for years, well, this group of districts need some money, and since we gave money to them, let's throw some over here to kind of balance it out. And those formulas need to be addressed to make it a lot more simple in my mind, and I think that would help the public in its transparency. So I guess less reliance on the categoricals, because I think if we have a stronger basic formula, but we absolutely have to address the needs of children who have special needs, be that special education or be that, you know, children who don't have an English language as a native language, and children who come from areas of poverty who need additional assistance. So it's maybe to focus on what is in that report that you really like and try to move forward from there. And I guess that the reliance on voter-approved levies to me needs to be addressed, that is something where we have taken what should be the discussion here and we put it on Main Street in many communities, and where we are asking voters to decide what is adequacy. That, to me, is probably some of the most important work that you can do. So that is my perspective and what I hope you continue to look at. But taking some of the things that make the most sense and then also looking at what parts of the formula just don't make any sense anymore. Why are they there?
Representative Gaffney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm appreciating, as I listen, I think I'm hearing some strong themes about starting and ending with the students and having a formula that hopefully provides greater equity across the state in terms of educational opportunities for students, because I think that is something we've been losing in different ways. Challenges in rural Minnesota, the declining enrollment, the sparsity issues that they've been experiencing there, and the difficulty in delivering a robust educational opportunity for students in the smaller districts. Costs outstripping funding in my district, so that we are less able to provide a robust, rich educational opportunity for students in some of the central cities. All of that compounded then by two, I think, countervailing forces, one being No Child Left Behind, forcing the narrowing of the curriculum to reading and math, and sometimes narrowing in of our funding discussions to be just how a kid's doing on reading and math tests. So on the flip side, parents wanting and research demonstrating the value of a broader curriculum, and that you know, it's good to turn out engineers, but even the engineers are better engineers if they've had a rich broad liberal arts sort of background as part of their education, allowing them to think more creatively as they go forward. And we're losing, the parents are demanding that, No Child Left Behind is pulling that out from under us, and we've got all of these complications. So I think if we start and end with the students and recognize the need for not a limited curriculum, but a comprehensive curriculum that develops the student, not just getting someone who can pass a test, but develops the intellect of the student, I think we'll do well.
Thank you.
With that, Madam Chair, Senator Saltzman and I are going to trade off. She came late and I'm leaving early. So
thank you.
I got the same number of legislators around the table.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Representative McFarland.
I don't have much to say that's in opposition of anybody. I'm in agreement. I do not believe that PS Minnesota ever came with the idea that they were here to tell us exactly what needs to be done. They always said this is something that we can work from. They've done a lot of research, mm-hmm. put a lot of time and effort into it, and I think bringing all those organizations together has been a wonderful thing that's happened, and I just want to make sure that we can use that as part of our resources. No matter what we do, I think that we should be encouraging and rewarding reform. The delivery of education today is much different, and it's going to be in the future, and our current formula doesn't really encourage that. And anyway, I just also want to reiterate that we should have some incentives for efficiencies. And the other point that I'd like to bring up is that I'm wondering about the special education funding. I've always had an issue with the district that the student happens to reside in gets the burden of some of those students, and I don't mean it as a burden, you know, in a negative way, but I just am wondering if there might be some other way to formulate that would be more evenly spread across the state on some of the cases where they have more severely challenged students.
Thank you. Something we'll add. You know, it is our hope that in having this discussion that we can actually ask our staff to spend some, and we're lucky our staff is with us today. Thank you for being here. To ask our staff to take some of the factors that we're talking about and work with us during, you know, the time between now and the next to look at how we might address some of these issues. And I think we've all taken that number one, we're going to start with the students, and I think we do want to have specific outcomes in mind. And I know that we all believe that each and every student's progress is important and that's also our focus. And then the fairness of the property tax levy as being such a big part of the funding formula seems to have outlived its usefulness, and so I think we'd all like to relook at that and make sure that each and every student in this state has an adequate and excellent education, not just adequate, but truly excellent. And so that is our commitment, and that's why we're here. I'm fortunate to be a part of the technology task force. I, alongside with Representative Winkler, have been working with the Department of Education
around ways to use technology to create efficiencies and to improve student learning. And so I know at some point they will, the task force will be presenting that work. So I'm hopeful as we look at our funding formula that at the same time we include efficiency and reform, because I think that is our charge as well. So, and to our presenters who came from afar, you know, Mr. Griffith, you're still in the audience. Do you have any other comments to add to this discussion? You're welcome to come to the table if you do. Please come join us.
Very quickly, but the special ed one I actually have an answer for. So
I don't have an answer.
I can't help you with property taxes, but there's been some really good studies lately that have looked into actual spending on special ed students and where the money's going and where it needs to go. They found that the largest group of special ed students are in the mild category, mm-hmm. and they only need about 20% more per student. But that should be taken account in a funding formula situation. The moderate students need about 50% more, and then the severe students need 100% additional funding. Again, you can take this into account in your funding formula. Then there are the kids that are the extremely high needs kids, and those are the ones we're seeing around the country that are causing the greatest financial burden. And really what states have decided with that, and they're starting to move to, that those students then become the state's responsibility. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. These are kids that cost $25,000 or more, that they are, for various reasons, disproportionately located. That you may have two districts that look exactly alike. One might have three or four of these students. The other might not have any. And you talk about a huge burden on a small mm-hmm. school district. These kids can really cause a lot of problems. So the states, and it's moving more and more this way, are talking about creating a fund where they then provide 100% funding for those children. They also then, the state, in an attempt to hold down the cost, then look at groups like the BOCES to educate them. So the education goes through a separate group, but the funding comes from the state. So.
There's several questions based on that. We'll start with Representative Garling, then Representative Heidegger-Kinn, and Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Griffin, Griffith, the PS Minnesota, I think I'm right, it was 0.9 for special ed, is that right? And then that was ELL. What was it for special ed? 0.7? Oh, it was just actual cost. Okay.
Predicated very much on
okay. Got it.
That takes care of my question.
Thank you. Thank you. I apologize, Mr. Griffith, for coming in late here. I sat an extra hour in traffic standstill at Monticello, so instead of a 2-hour and 10-minute ride, it was a 3.5-hour ride in this morning. So anyways, but I have a question in regards to, are there any states that are allowing 4-day schools? I mean, if we look at... there's a report out that shows Minneapolis, for example, spending 336 minutes a day in a classroom. Lind, a small little school district, is spending 480 minutes a day. They are spending an extra day or even more a week with their students than, say, for example, Minneapolis. Have some school districts, like those rural districts, that tend to get their students there and have a longer day. Are there some allowances made in other states where they can do... I used to teach during the energy crisis. Our school district went down to a 4-day, and actually really worked out very well. Are there some states that allow school districts to do that?
Yes, there are. It's basically in most of the states that allow that. It's a waiver process, and you have to go to the state, and then you have to ask to do it. Kentucky has done it with a decent amount of their district. Colorado has done it. We've seen it in a couple of other states. There was sort of, about 3-4 years ago, there was a ramp-up of this. The possibility had always existed, but very few of the districts had applied for it. But once we saw the price of gasoline obviously increase, that was a main issue, because not only did it increase the transportation costs, but the heating costs went up. So, and in some states, they have minimum days that you need to serve, but in other states, they have minimum hours.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and in some, it's one or the other. You can choose from the two. So in those places, that it's much easier to do one of these if you have the minimum hours per year. So they're doing exactly what you're talking about, putting their weekly hours in 4 days. I have not heard anyone go below 4 days. You know, I have not heard a school district go to 3 or something like that. And this had always been around, especially in places located in mountainous areas. They had switched, they had gone to 4 days because of the transportation issues and all that, but it is something.
Representative Heidegger, and I'm just kind of curious because I would think that being in the classroom more hours is producing higher student outcomes. Do you find that true?
Yes, the small school districts have done it. I know they have, their outcomes are very high. But the thing is, we have out there from the school districts, students are spending over 2 hours a morning just getting to school on a bus. Mm-hmm. And 4 hours a day, they're spending on the bus plus. And then you get out in Daveville District, represent Daveville District, the students, some of them stay at houses during the week. Mm-hmm. Because the bus, they're too far away. Mm-hmm. And I know that my dad and all of my uncles and aunts had to move to town during the school year in order to get an education. So it's still being used in some of the rural school districts. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Representative Heidegger. And there's an example of how online learning is perhaps a useful tool.
Mr. Griffith, I'm wondering what states are states that model that statewide takeover of funding for the extreme cases. Could you give me some examples of states?
Pennsylvania has done that. And, you know, I can't think of the others off the top of my head right now, but I can get an email address. I'll make sure to get that to you, the ones we know.
Mr. Griffith, are there any factors, I know you've read our report, that you've identified that we haven't put in that, or any nuances that you want to mention that you've observed?
No, I thought it was a good report. I think with any of these reports, you have to understand that they're based on educational expectations. And they take the different groups work in different ways to figure out how to cost out those educational expectations. The people who run these studies, Ogden, Blake, and Pleitch did the initial underlying study. What John Meyer did, if I understand correctly, was summarize, I think, and go back and update some of the stuff that APA had done originally. But the studies that APA does, the studies that the other organizations like them do, they will even admit they're not 100%, that they give you best estimates of what those educational attainments will cost. Right now, there is no perfect system where you can plug into a computer, I want 65% of my kids to do this, 70% to do that, and then there'll be a cost coming out the other end. Mm-hmm. Something like that exists, and I'd be unemployed tomorrow. So, we would like to aim towards that at some point. Those groups talk about coming up with something like that, but right now, it's more of a sort of an estimate. They're the best things that are out there, though. So if you agree with what their education attainment levels are, then you can use that as a number to work off of, to kind of adjust. Some of the weights that they talk about, I've worked with John Meyer and I've worked with APA and the other group. I know they've gone through and they've looked at research just like I'm talking about. There, again, even within this research, there's some movement within those, but it gives you, again, a good idea that this is probably the range of the weights you want to give the ESL, this is the range of the weights you want to give to special ed, to the other programs that are out there. You were talking about the Arizona program, which is similar to the California program, which is the English Language Immersion program. In those cases, you're making a clear policy decision that then you can map off your costs from that. Mm-hmm. And in those cases, you only receive ESL funding for 2 years for each student in the program. And the funding side, then the policy side, is that you have to immerse and they have to be at a certain level within a certain time period. There are other states that look at it as a 5-year program or something else like that. Then there's a different cost base to it. So even once you've chosen the attainment levels, there are other policy decisions that you've made in your state that will make those adjustments. The property tax decisions that you've made in the state will also impact all of this, because you're talking about then how do you do the balance of state to local funding. How do you mandate then, once you come up with that number, that the locals have to match it? There are states that have done that. Or do you turn around and say, we're going to hope they get up to this, but if they don't, then we'll supply our share, and then their share is just kind of left blank. So, you know, whatever study has been done for you, you also have to take in your own wishes, your own realities, and put it into that, too. So.
Thank you.
Yes.
Commissioner?
Mr. Griffith, too, on your, when you mentioned the special education funding formula, our state doesn't fund based on disability category. It's a cost or proportion of a cost of your special education. Do you
how do states define the severely disabled student that would be getting, where the state would pick up the whole cost? Do they have a specific?
They do. Most of them. You'll look at some states like Texas, and they have a 7 or 8 sort of level system as you move up,
mm-hmm.
and then they define exactly what is mild, what is moderate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they put, you know, students who are hearing impaired or visually impaired sort of in the mid range. They put students who have mild, they might have something like dyslexia in the lower, but they really pretty clearly map it out about who, mm-hmm. where each student goes within the ladder of funding system.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I don't know all the categories of special ed, that's not my field, but, you know, that's basically how they do it. It is clearly defined.
And when you were talking about the ELL, you know, the California and, was it Arizona?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. One of the things, too, that we haven't talked about, you know, even with their, you know, real intensive insistence of, you know, educating or 4 hours the first year, and I wasn't sure what happened in the subsequent years, and so you're saying it's a 2-year limit.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you could even talk about, you know, front loading, you know, if you wanted to do that very intensive kind of work with students, and then phasing the cost down, because your assumption would be that they should be progressing. And that was one of the things that when I was in the legislature I was concerned about, was we were funding ELL, but it was an open-ended, you could just keep getting ELL money forever and ever without any, you know, accountability or holding the school districts accountable for making sure that they were actually learning and getting through and you know, eventually learning English. So that's another thing that, you know, you could look at, is just really intensively doing that kind of a process. When you've got a student that's coming in at 15 years of age from a refugee camp, and you're expecting them in, you know, 3 years to, you know, do all this stuff, they're not going to. But if you had a really intensive, I always said, why aren't we just more intensely, you know, throwing them into a longer period of time, not this kind of pull-out thing, but just focusing on that, and then you could, you know, try to do some cost based on that. It might be the same amount, it might be a little bit more, but it might be more effective process. But just another thing, I think those are the things we need to kind of grapple with as we're looking at this. Can we do things differently than we're doing now?
And California is talking about getting away from their system and offering bonuses when you move a kid off of ESL. And once they score a certain score on the TOEFL exam, then you as a district then get $2,500, I think that's the number that we're looking at, for each kid you move from that to out of the program. It's, again, an incentive program to benefit them for doing a good job, kind of thing, but it's a different way of thinking.
Thank you. Representative Garland?
And I appreciate those. And I think that those are the kind of discussions that we're going to be having, and from my mind, is taking the PS Minnesota report. It sounds like we're agreed that the cost differentials that they have outlined aren't too different from those that we have right now, but we can take their suggested changes and tweak them. And like the ELL, last year the governor recommended and the commissioner changing the 5-year cap to 7. The House, we took off the cap, but then we also took out the concentration factor like PS Minnesota does. And I've often thought, except for a concentration factor, just exactly what the commissioner just suggested. You know, somebody that's fresh off the boat, it seems to me they need really intensive services. So to have more money for them, but someone who's been trying to learn for 10 years, and if they still haven't, they could be tapering off because surely they've learned something. And so I think there's many ways to skin the cat. But am I correct in summarizing that people here would like to change around the PS Minnesota report, but we could use it as a working document to start with the suggestions that they made, as I think it was Representative McFarland and Senator Salzman said, it was never meant to be adopted carte blanche, but instead a place to start.
Do I see nods on the table? Any objections? Okay, so I think we will ask the staff to work with us in this interim time to look at what that might look like, and then knowing that we will ask for some specific changes to what has been presented.
I very much thank the people around the table today for your thoughtful discussions and your questions and your comments, and I thank the presenters and all of you who joined us at the hearing today. Thank you.